It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We also have Mike McCormack back in the studio.
That's right.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
From your vacation.
How is Norway?
It's beautiful there. It is absolutely pristine and amazing. In some ways, it has similar looks to the San Juans. But it
sounds like I was in Alaska for a couple weeks. That's where I was gone for a couple weeks back there.
Yeah, the people in Norway said that it's very similar to Alaska. I'm assuming they've been to Alaska and weren't just talking about the postcards. But, you know, they got 30,000 islands in Norway, and Finland, where I was, 188,000 lakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just taking their word for it. So anyway.
Yeah, you didn't sit there
and count. Didn't actually count, yeah.
But it turns out while I'm gone, I thought I could, leave and rest easy. But you guys failed me. Apparently John Bolton was put into the UN.
Yes, he was.
Okay. Yeah, it really wasn't our fault, but...
I'm holding you responsible.
And we did talk about it.
Okay, good.
So we didn't let it slip
by unnoticed.
Which is
all we really ever do.
Yeah, it's kind of up to other people to speak up and try to change things, but yeah.
All right.
We do our best.
Well, let's start with some local stuff, and maybe you can bring me up to speed. Apparently, this last week, Greg Nichols has made an announcement about the monorail. He's putting his foot down, or?
Yeah, he made an ultimatum to the monorail board. He said, if you folks don't come up with a plan by September 15th that can be put on the ballot for voters to vote on, then the city might just take unilateral action and decide to kill the monorail. Of course, the city, Greg Nichols, doesn't really have the authority to do that, but he does have the authority to deny permits to the monorail construction companies. Which is what he said he would do, which is how he would kill it.
And let's be clear, the monorail board is in no shape to come up with that kind of a plan by September 15th.
It's not
going to happen.
Yeah, it's not much time. And Nichols has basically said to the monorail board, look, you've got two options. I mean, it's very Clint Eastwood-like, you know, to say to them, come up with a plan by my date or else it's going to, you know, go down in flames. And here, by the way, if you're going to come up with a plan, here are your two options. Basically, he said, you can either come up with a ballot measure that raises taxes, or you can come up with a plan that has a shorter route. That's basically what he said.
Those are the options.
Which you know, they kind of are. They are two options, but there are other options out there, too. And giving the monorail board just about a month to work on it is not a whole heck of a lot of time, especially if you want to come up with a plan for a shorter route. That's going to take a little longer than a month, I think. Now, there are other options out there.
And by the way, if you're going to do it in a month, that virtually precludes any possibility of public input.
Yeah, it does. And in fact, the public has some pretty good ideas. And it was something we said before, too, when we said that the monorail board had its closed meetings, that it really shut out some of the best feedback it could have gotten on its proposals from the public. This one-month deadline is going to do the same thing. There are some folks out there talking about maybe constructing two monorail lines, one from Ballard to Westlake and one from West Seattle to King Street Station.
Taking out the downtown link,
and that would take out a lot of the opposition to the monorail because it's mostly downtown folks who have been campaigning against it. That's a possibility, but you know, it's going to take a lot longer than a month for the monorail board or anyone to come up with a plan that could be put before voters that would give that as an option. So I think we're seeing Nichols, who's been a longtime monorail foe. He's very pro Sound Transit light rail, but has always been against the monorail. Even when he's kind of gritted his teeth and smiled and said, oh, yes, we're going to go forward with it, we're really giving him he's really kind of taking the opportunity to try and kill this thing now.
Yeah, and notice that he waited until after the filing deadline for candidacy so that no mayoral opposition could jump in before he issued his ultimatum.
Yeah.
That was very Clint Eastwood-like also,
yeah,
I thought.
Very cynical.
Showed a lot of class.
All right. Anything else on that? Or moving over, we've got...
No, I think my day is made.
Okay, well, you're set then. Bush has some plans for the salmon habitats here locally. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, actually, not just locally, all throughout the Pacific Northwest and California. The Bush administration announced, I believe yesterday, actually, that it was revising the critical habitat definitions for salmon runs on the West Coast, basically eliminating the critical habitat designation for runs in which salmon are not currently present or that were historically present but are in diminished numbers now. And rather than trying to restore these waterways, the thinking goes, try and focus protection on waterways that have major salmon runs currently. The problem with this, of course, is that by doing that, you're precluding the possibility of recovery for salmon to their original habitats, and this is part of the endangered species what the Endangered Species Act requires. So this may not stand up to the inevitable environmental lawsuit that will follow, but we'll see. It's definitely something that that is bad news for environmentally concerned salmon protectors.
Yeah, and it's a ruling that came on the heels of a lawsuit by property owners and developers. So right now we're seeing this all being fought out in the courts. The other side, the environmentalists have been suing the government for years over these kinds of decisions, but now we're seeing the other side get in on the act too, and it's a battle being fought out in the courts, which I don't think is probably the best place for it to happen.
All right.
Yeah, very true.
And we might have time here at the end for possibility of taking some emails from listeners if they want to send them in at that DJ.
Folks who have questions that they want us to answer.
KEXP.org.
We'll try our best.
But we make no guarantees. So.
And try to keep the questions brief because that gives us more time to answer.
Yeah.
What was the address again?
DJ@KEXP.org.
Okay.
All right. Well, moving along, I didn't get a chance while I was traveling to catch very much of the news that was going on here in the States. I was kind of stuck with randomly catching CNN, which, you know, it's funny because you can go like day after day and it's pretty much the same thing coming out of CNN. But one of the things that they were covering every day, given plenty of time to, was the situation with Iran and restarting their nuclear program.
Yeah, Iran has been under the eyes of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association of the UN, and the IAEA has put under seal much of Iran's uranium enrichment program because, as we know, uranium enrichment can lead to higher speed and more efficient nuclear reactors, or it can also produce nuclear weapons. Now, Iran, as we know, is also at least a decade, if not more, from actually producing a bomb. Their uranium enrichment program is extremely small, and it's just in its very beginning stages. But this week, Iran broke the seals and went in and restarted uranium enrichment. And the IAEA told them, well, you have now a September 3rd deadline if you don't stop or come to some kind of an agreement where Europe and the United States can provide you nuclear technology that can only be used for peaceful means in exchange for other things, then we're going to take you to the Security Council, possibly, and slap sanctions on. Well, this comes at a time when the Bush administration is still refusing to negotiate with North Korea, who has said that, yes, they actually have the capability, if not already have, nuclear weapons, and Pakistan, who this week tested their first cruise missile. Cruise missiles can fly, you know, without radar detection. They can also be based on submarines, and as we know, Pakistan has tested a nuclear weapon. So,
and it has submarines.
And it has submarines, yes. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy going on here with the Bush administration leaning very heavily on the IAEA and the UN to slap sanctions on Iran, but they're ignoring some of the worst nuclear scofflaws in the world, including Pakistan, who is our ally in the war on terror, in spite of the fact that some of the worst terrorist attacks in recent days have come from folks who have traveled to and trained in Pakistan. And you could certainly say that Pakistan harbors more potential terrorists than Iran does. And North Korea, who also has tested a medium-range missile and is probably developing a long-range missile and may already have nuclear weapons.
And let's not forget Pakistan's role in supplying nuclear materials to North Korea, to Libya, to, you know, a variety
other regimes,
of,
yeah.
of bad regimes.
And probably also to Iran.
Yeah.
And how frail Pakistan's government is.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it is to a certain extent, but Pakistan is also, its government is also a dictatorship,
right.
A military dictatorship. So
right,
there's that in the equation as well.
Well, I was intrigued by
when Bush talks about supporting, you know, democracy around the world.
I was intrigued by your comment about nuclear technology that can only be used for people peaceful purposes that the U.S. is trying to get in there. I didn't realize we had that.
Well, there is certain nuclear technology that you can't immediately use to make bomb fuel or fuel that can be used in bombs, and that's what the Bush administration is talking about. Iran, of course, already has much of that stuff, and what they're doing is they're enriching their uranium in order to make it a little higher grade, but it can be used in much more efficient reactors, but can also be used for nuclear weapons. And now a lot of people have said, why would Iran even need to develop a nuclear industry because they have so much oil? You know, I mean, that is a good question. However, as we know, the Bush administration has been threatening to attack Iran, you know, having called them part of the axis of evil and now having bases on both sides of the country in Afghanistan on one of their borders and in Iraq on the other border. Iran needs a nuclear deterrent, you know, to hold off the rabid reactionary Bush administration to keep them from invading.
And let's be clear, when the Bush administration said, you know, we can do preemptive strikes, we can invade anybody we want at any time for any reason.
And we will.
and they did. This is what you get in return. You get regimes making the very clear realpolitik decision that we need to develop deterrence against these kind of attacks. You get the North Koreas, you get the Iran saying, what works? Well, what works is a nuclear deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and that's why the Bush administration is making a big thing of this thing with Iran, but not North Korea. North Korea may already have the bomb, in which case attacking them would be very bad policy. But Iran is a decade or more away from having a nuclear weapon, and so the Bush administration figures they could attack Iran if they wanted to and not suffer anything from it. Of course, the people who do suffer are people like Casey Sheehan, the son of Cindy Sheehan, who are sent over to Iraq to fight George Bush's war, and they die.
Well, and it's leaving just the nuclear weapons factor out of it. It's kind of funny seeing the U.S. energy bill, you know, which includes, you know, big push for expanding our nuclear development and energy production.
Yeah, we haven't actually built a nuclear power plant in the United States for more than 30 years, but the Bush administration certainly would not like to see our nuclear weapons technology go down either, because they've been pushing that as well.
Yeah, this is an energy bill, by the way, from 1975. It promotes all the coal and non-renewable energy sources and completely ignores the new renewable technologies that have been developed in the last 30 years. It's really quite sad.
All right. Well, anything else on that? Or
let's move on.
We'll move over to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The August 15th deadline for the new Iraqi parliament to approve a constitution is quickly approaching. It will arrive on Monday. However, the draft constitution is nowhere near finished. There are many, many, many contentious issues still outstanding, but the major one is federalism. Excuse me. Now, for folks who aren't familiar with what federalism is, it is a discussion about the distribution of power between the federal government and various autonomous or possibly autonomous regions at the local level. Now, the Kurds want an autonomous Kurdish region in the north of the country. They want that region to have a lot of power and the federal government to be fairly weak. And the Sunnis would prefer the opposite. They would like the federal government to be very strong and the local regions to be rather weak. Now, the Shiites weighed in this week with the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq coming forward and telling reporters, well, we want an autonomous region in the south as well, a Shiite autonomous region with the capital being Basra, the second largest city in Iraq. Skiri, the Supreme Council, already controls Basra, the city of Basra. They have a majority on the city council, and they also have most of the high-level positions in the police force, as well as running these religious militias throughout the city, which also crack down on folks who are not adhering to Sharia law. Now, what this would do is if the Shiites controlled the south of Iraq, they would also control 80 to 90% of Iraq's oil resources and the only ports in the nation. Now, folks who have been looking at this whole issue say that giving too much autonomy to the local regions would create an independent or autonomous region in the north, which might lead to an independent Kurdistan. It's a possibility. Creating a Shiite autonomous region in the south would break up the nation entirely. That would also create a portion of the country that is either strongly allied or possibly might be annexed by Iran. Since the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and a few other of the Shiite religious groups have pretty strong ties to Iran, and are also leaning towards very close cooperation with Iran. Now, this would leave the Sunnis isolated in the middle of the country with no resources and no revenue, and would almost definitely and particularly guarantee a continuation of the civil war. Now, the constitutional referendum, which if they do actually come to some kind of agreement by Monday, which I doubt, I think they're going to need an extension of time. But if they do come to some kind of agreement and the parliament votes for it, because, of course, the Shiites have a majority in parliament, and if they can join together with the Kurds, they could pass this thing. The constitutional referendum would happen in October, where the whole nation gets to vote. People would go to the polls and vote on the constitution. There's a little clause that says that a two-thirds majority in three provinces could scuttle the referendum, could scuttle the Constitution. So far, people have been looking at, well, we got to give the Kurds what they want because they could scuttle the referendum. They control three provinces. However, there's a Sunni majority in at least three provinces as well. They could also, and they are beginning to threaten that now, they could also scuttle the Constitution if it includes really strong references to autonomous local regions. So that's another problem. If it gets past this August 15th deadline, there's still the October 15th vote. But what we know is that whatever the Supreme Council wants, they usually get one way or the other. This week, they exercised that power by staging a municipal coup d'etat in Baghdad. Baghdad's secular mayor, Ala al-Tamimi, he was kicked out of office by the head of the city council, who is an adherent of the Supreme Council. He went into the mayor's office with about 100 armed men and basically booted the guy out and installed a new mayor, who is a member of the Badr Brigades. That's the armed militia group that is controlled by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Tellingly, there were no protests over this move because the old mayor had been installed by Paul Bremer when he was U.S. Viceroy of Iraq. So not only does the Supreme Council control Basra, but they're also moving to take control of Baghdad as well, the capital city. Now, meanwhile, the Bush administration has been babbling about bombs being shipped to the Sunni insurgency by the Shiite government of Iran. Now, this is pretty ridiculous, and in fact, several of the British commanders in Iraq have said that they have seen very little evidence of this, and they don't think it's a credible claim. So folks might be asking, why is the Bush administration pushing this stuff? Well, the answer's not too difficult.
They want to make war with Iran.
Yeah, they want to make war with Iran. They're afraid of Iran's influence over the Shiite groups in Iraq who are taking control. They're also, at the same time that Iran is starting its uranium enrichment process, they're also kind of waving this as a flag against them. And also, we have to understand, too, that Bush himself is under attack by the American public because more and more people are coming to realize that we went to war in Iraq for no very good reason.
Yeah, the Sunday Sheehan protest has been just remarkable in its ability to generate not only a tremendous amount of media, but also, I mean, folks are flocking to Crawford.
A lot of heat.
Yeah, I mean, there a lot of military family survivors are going to Crawford to support Cindy Sheehan, and it's putting a lot of pressure on Bush.
Yeah,
it's been remarkable.
His poll numbers have gotten very, very low. His approval ratings is down under 40%, which in fact it's been kind of lingering around 40% for most of the year. Of course, we haven't been hearing that much from the news media, but Bush is not very popular right now, and a big part of that reason is because Americans are still dying and Iraqis are still dying in Iraq long after the Bush administration said that the war was over, and their Bush administration has not come up with any credible reason for us to be over there other than we want their oil, and that, I think, is also another reason why the Bush administration is starting to really attack Iran a lot. Is that, well,
we
now
want
in
their
this
oil.
Day and age when oil prices are at record highs and it looks like the supply may eventually run out, we're getting closer to that date, we want their oil.
$67 a barrel at my last count.
And getting close to 70 sooner rather than later.
Well, it surprises me that no one, you know, the Bush administration has actually pushed for just having him go out and talk to her. I mean, that would pretty much dissipate that.
Well, he did send somebody out to talk to her. Stephen Hadley.
No,
who
I mean,
was,
like, he going out to talk to
yeah.
her, bringing her in, you know, next to the pool for a little chat or something.
Yeah. Well, as we know, Stephen Hadley is George Bush's guy who reads the newspaper, since George doesn't read the newspaper himself. He has his national security advisor do that. So it made sense to send Stephen Hadley out there, but it also is a chicken move. You know, George doesn't know anything much about the war, and he didn't know anything much about the boys who've died over there, as Cindy Sheehan has said of her first interview with Bush when she was still in shock from her son's death.
Which was at Fort Lewis.
Yeah, which was at Fort Lewis. George didn't know the name of her son, didn't know her name, obviously, since he called her Mom throughout the interview, which is a pretty belittling way to address someone whose son has died in your cause. He should go out and meet with her. Instead, he drove by her in his SUV with the windows rolled up on his way to a Republican fundraiser on Thursday, where he garnered millions of dollars for the reelection of Republicans. But he couldn't stop and roll down the window and just say hi.
All right. Well, got a few questions in via email. So if you are ready to go.
Fire away.
First one is from Mike in Bremerton. How much of a political risk does Mayor Nichols take when he rhetorically beats up on strippers?
Virtually none.
And it might actually boost his political stance in the eyes particularly of moms in tennis shoes and other more conservative Seattle residents.
Yeah, it's really the other way around. Who's gonna stand up for the poor beleaguered strippers in Seattle?
And in this case, it was Councilman McIver who said, "Wait, let's not just pass this thing. Let's hold off for a couple of days and actually hear what they have to say."
Although, not to praise too much, put too much praise on the city council. Remember that the city council is the organization that has, for many years now, every year, continued to pass a moratorium on the building of new strip clubs in Seattle. So you gradually had them go out of business. So there's now only four or five left in the city. Because there's this moratorium on the building of them that is passed year after year after year by the city council, again, with no political risk whatsoever.
I thought it was intriguing. I think it was Nichols that proposed the 4-foot rule for strippers at clubs, mm-hmm. and all I could think of, if you would only push for that, like with lobbyists, like Vulcan.
Yeah, that would be good.
That'd be good.
That'd be good. More like a 40-foot rule.
I want to know who the consultants are that they hired that came up with 4 as opposed to 3 or 5. How did they determine that number?
Yeah.
How did they research that?
All right. That's another show. All right. Next question. Are you aware of any proposed legislation regarding Social Security? Have you read anything about the Working for America Act or civil service reform? That's from Bianca.
Actually, I haven't heard anything about any of those acts. I am familiar with the Bush administration's policies on Social Security, but not on any other alternative ones.
Yeah, I'm similarly ignorant.
All right.
Sorry.
And finally, quickly, let's see, I'll skip to question 2 on this from Bob in Lake Forest Park, since the first part is rhetorical. What about that melting peat bog in Siberia?
I assume he's talking about global warming.
I'm hoping.
There's actually been some interesting stuff on global warming recently. Like, for example, there were some anti-global warming scientists, there are a few, paid usually by oil companies, who had done some work on measuring the temperature of the air in the troposphere, in the atmosphere between sort of close to ground level and high up in the sky. And they had concluded that the troposphere is actually cooling. Well, when some other scientists came in and looked at all their data and ran it through some more, I guess you would call,
rigorous
calculations, they actually found that the troposphere is indeed warming and that this is probably a sign of global warming. So one of the main arguments that people who are against global warming use to say that the Earth is actually cooling rather than warming up has just been shot down this week.
All right, well, that's all the time we got for questions for this week. We'll try and save the other ones for next week. Important or big event coming up today? You guys are going to be there.
Rolling
yes.
Thunder.
Hello. Rolling Thunder. Magnuson Park, noon to 5 o'clock. There's a $10 admission, I believe, but there's entertainment, bands and whatnot. There's workshops at, I believe, 1 and 2:30. We'll be there with a table for Eat the Steak, so you can come in and meet us and buy T-shirts and other paraphernalia, and we'll even sign them for you if you really want.
yeah, I'll have to bring my pen.
Yeah. yeah, you can pull out your Sharpie and do that. We'll be there. Rolling Thunder, Magnuson Park. Come and join us.
All right. Well, and with that, talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Go ahead.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, other places where you pick up free periodicals, like your local library, etc. And we can also be found online, and I think our website is now up to date at www.eatthestate.org.